Well, greetings everyone. Welcome to another episode of Sermon Talk Plus Plus. Today I have with me to my left Donna Boss.
Hello.
And DJ Barresso.
Good evening.
And Becky Watson.
Hello.
And Joe Dubois. He made it past his probation.
I passed the test, yeah.
I think he's still on probation.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know. I listened to a listener on Sunday and they complimented me on being here.
Oh, wow.
So somebody listens.
Someone does listen.
News to me.
That's the test.
I do too. Well, the passage for tonight, for this week, is from James chapter 3, verse 13 through 18. It's right after the passage about faith without works is dead. And so it says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness." So what do you see as your first pass, big ideas, main points? What are the things you observe? Who would be willing to start first?
It's interesting that the topic of good deeds and showing your faith and your understanding, your wisdom through the deeds, that was interesting. Then I see the list of bad, negative things about earthly wisdom and or harboring bitterness. And then you have a list of good things, almost like fruit of the Spirit. You have pure, peace-loving, considerate, full of mercy, good fruit. So I thought that was quite interesting that you have the two types of wisdom compared in that paragraph.
Yeah, they're contrasted. But the title I took a clue from the NIV's heading, said two kinds of wisdom, but my title is Earthly or Heavenly Wisdom. So
the description, the negative part, says wisdom in parentheses, and it has all the negative aspects. So that would be one kind. And then it says it does not come down from heaven, but it's earthly. And then the next paragraph has wisdom that comes from heaven, and that's all the positive characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Other observations.
I thought it was interesting that in verse 13 there's a sense of humility in the good deeds that comes from wisdom. And I guess thinking back to the sermon last week, the connection between the external and the internal, the tongue and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that when we live a good life, we really can't boast about it because it's from the inward work.
Okay, so some warning against boasting that way, and it is connected to the having deeds, like Donna and you mentioned also the DJ. The context flows well from the previous topic. Any other observations?
I think it's surprising in some ways to that James chose bitter envy and selfish ambition. To be like the description of the source of earthly wisdom or the primary earthly wisdom. I don't know if I would have picked those. Because then he says in verse 16, when you have envy and selfish ambition, then you find disorder in every evil practice. So it's sort of like the source of, you know, like how money is, love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. He's saying that envy and selfish ambition are the...
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that James assumes that there's actually wisdom that is openly proud of
its
bitter envy and selfish ambition. That's the part that threw me back, because with my Christian sensitivities of being raised in my family and in the environments that I've been in, I would never admit to being openly envious and selfish ambition. I'm certainly have had it, but I wouldn't necessarily openly admit to it. So
if I had to imagine someone who was proud of their ambition and envy, the picture I think of is someone that's on social media right now. I can't even think of an ancient example. Right. Like, I mean, obviously it'd be hard for me to think of an ancient example.
Right. There must
it's
have
hard
been.
For me to imagine right. that, yeah.
Well, what kind of strikes me as interesting in here is, one, you kind of said this, John, the idea of wisdom having a negative component in of itself is something that, I mean, often we use wisdom as kind of like hand in hand with righteousness, right? And, or like a positive descriptor of what a good person is like is someone who's wise. But this shows here that wisdom in and of itself does not necessarily imply moral goodness. So there can be a wrong wisdom.
There's like a bad wisdom.
And there's a bad wisdom and a good wisdom. Yeah. And then kind of going to what Becky was saying is it seems like if you're going... So if wisdom in of itself is just a descriptor of what's the smart way to act given your background or something along those lines, if your background is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic, then what should, if there is no God and if the moral rules don't exist, then what you should do is accrue everything for yourself all the time, right? You should be selfish. You should have ambition because you must climb over everyone else, right? So when I think of, like you were talking about an ancient example, what we probably have here is like a Caesar, right? An emperor of or a kingdom who tramples down everything else in order to obtain the maximum amount of power and wealth for themselves. That is the most wise thing for him to do, is to make himself as if a god to rule everyone else.
Anyone who's an aggressive power seeker would say so, right? I mean, this is the teachings of Nietzsche that influenced the whole generation, right? To seek the Superman, the true individual is a person who asserts themselves. And even if there isn't an ancient example, it does seem to be the tone of our age, is the way you advance yourself in today's world is to assert yourself. I'm the greatest. I deserve, this kind of thing. I don't know if it relates, but it sort of does, I think. My son, Davin, is going to school in Boston at Berkeley, and one of the professors from Berkeley, he told me this about a week ago, that one of the professors contacted him or was in conversation with him. He does a lot of networking, and the professor said, it's a good thing you're from the Midwest, because the kids that come from the coast are so into themselves, have been told that they're the greatest so long that they can hardly get along with anybody. And he said, and this professor said, so it's good that you have that background. And it's also good because when you go back home, they'll put you back in your place if you get too big for your britches. And I listed his sisters in my mind right away.
Because he mentioned to me the other day, David did, that some of his classmates, his future classmates, intimidate him. I said, oh, that's good for you.
But the point is that there really are subcultures and cultures that promote, that teach the idea that, hey, the way to be great is to go for it and to declare yourself great and act cocky and demand. I'm reminded of the character in the movie Elf that wanted to be picked up in a car that was exactly 68 degrees and, all that. That the hero of our world is somebody who demands to be served.
There's a big movement, especially in teaching how young men are supposed to act based on social media. Mm-hmm. There are names of Andrew Tate and other similar things, and basically what they teach you is how to be the most masculine man you can be, and what good masculinity is always being in control, doing whatever you want,
getting what you
make
want,
business,
yeah.
Take every opportunity,
climb on people, step on
oh
people.
Yeah, you're what matters, you are the strongest. If you would just work hard, you can be fabulously rich and no one can stop you and no one wants to tell you this kind of thing. And it leads a lot, it sounds really great, and because it sounds like you're saying I can be a Superman, right? I can do whatever I want.
There was that Christian, quote-unquote, women's book a while ago, the Girl Wash Your Face book. I can't remember the author. Do you remember the author, Donna?
I've never heard of it.
Okay, so she was like a social media influencer, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. But she was a Christian, and she wrote a book about, like, telling Christian women you need to stop... you know, there's probably some good advice in it. You know, like, stop wallowing, you know, stand up, wash your face, get your work done or whatever. But the downfall, you know, the people that reviewed it is that, you know, she talked about defining success as getting a specific designer handbag that she really wanted and she worked hard to get it, or, you know, having a very specific materialistic life. You know, and that really is the opposite of what we're called to do as Christians, to pursue material wealth for an end in itself and all that stuff. So it could probably come in subtle ways into Christianity when it's aligns with your culture, you know.
The word for wisdom in verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? And then let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. That in the Greek is Sophia, Sophos, you know, the prefix to sophomore, and sophisticated. And so it's the same word that's used in verse 15 that the NIV puts quote marks around. It says, such Sophia does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. So James is using the same word to describe, I think what you said, Joe, is this body of advice. How should you live your life? That wisdom literature, that wisdom background can either be God's version of wisdom that James first refers to, or it can be this selfish, human-based wisdom that is based on envy and selfish ambition. And so it really is, I guess, just like the author of Proverbs says to his son in the early chapters, you need to choose wisdom. You know, stolen waters are sweet. It's fun to, you know, don't listen to those who say, let's be violent, let's take advantage of this. Or don't listen to the person that says, let's be a mocker, right? So there is a voice, advice out there trying to pull us all the time into what the Bible regards as folly, but the world thinks is wisdom, right? There is a way that seems right to a man, but it's the wrong thing in God's eyes. And so earthly wisdom is human wisdom, and that's, if you don't have God in your picture, you would say, hey, assert yourself. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The only way to really live is the one with the most toys wins kind of things. And I think that, and James accurately describes that as bitter envy and selfish ambition. That's the motivation. And he says, if you do have, don't boast about it, so don't be proud of it, but also don't deny that it's true, which is an interesting rebuke.
There's a post that's been on Facebook several times that compares earthly wisdom with Jesus' wisdom, and there's one of the things says, you know, follow your heart, and Jesus says, follow me. And another one is, be true to yourself. And Jesus says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny himself. There one says, believe in yourself. And Jesus says, believe in me. Another one says, live your truth. Jesus said, I'm the truth. Mm-hmm. And it's like the world has all these things that they think that we need to know and need to do. And many times they're the opposite of what God says to do. If someone hurts you, you get revenge. You get them back. Jesus doesn't say to do that.
That truth one kind of really resonates with me, because there's this big idea, and I think it's kind of alluded to in this passage as well. In verse 14, do not, in my version it says, and be false to the truth. I think in your version that you read was, or deny the truth. And it's such a common thing. The wisdom of our day is to, whatever is true for you is true for you, right? And this is wisdom in our day, because if you say that something is the real truth and the other thing is false, then that is to be mean to someone else. That is to belittle someone else. That is to, in some extreme examples, that is hate speech, right? To say that something is true or not true. Mm-hmm. And so the wisdom of today is whatever is true for you is true for you, and whatever is true for me is true for me. And the relativity of truth is sometimes expressed as a wise or philosophical idea, when it's just not true. It's false. It's not true wisdom. And the reason why it kind of resonates, stuck out to me in this verse 14, is because it doesn't say, or do not boast or lie or bear false witness. It's to deny the truth or be false to the truth, which is different than lying, which I think is an interesting difference that stands out in this passage. Is it's not, and it talks later on about someone who has God's wisdom is impartial and sincere, and so there is like bearing proper witness later on when talking about good wisdom. But in here it's kind of interesting, this idea to deny the truth being a specific aspect of the world's wisdom.
And if you look at the crucifixion, one of the things that happened when Jesus was talking to Pilate is Pilate was asking him, are you a king or not? And Jesus talks about, my kingdom's not from here. And so Pilate says, well, you are a king then. And Jesus said, you say I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Retorted Pilate. What's truth? Mm-hmm. He didn't even know. Mm-hmm. He was a person educated and high in command, and he didn't know what truth was.
So again, that was a classic clash of God's wisdom versus man's wisdom, God's power versus man's power. You know, Pilate thought he was in charge, and little did he realize that he was not in charge at all. Yeah, so it's interesting. What were you going to say, Becky?
But in this context, it's more narrow. James is saying, don't boast about your envy or ambition, and don't deny. I'm assuming when he says deny the truth, I interpret it as the truth of the fact that they're selfish and envious.
Where does it say that the boasting is boasting of your jealousy and selfish ambition? Maybe my version just says it differently.
14.
Yeah. If you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it.
Oh, it does say about it in here? Yeah. Okay, mine just doesn't say that.
Yeah, or deny the truth. What did you say?
What version?
Mine just says, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, comma, do not boast and be false to the truth.
Do you have the ESV?
Yeah, ESV. All right, so in that context, I guess it is a little different. It is more specific. But if you... wouldn't that be contradictory? So if you have jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it and be false to the truth about it. Isn't that...
That's how I interpret it.
And isn't that contradicting each other in the sense of, why would you deny the truth of you being boastful while also boasting about it?
So if you're an envious and selfish person, there's two things you should do. Mm-hmm. First one is, don't boast about being selfish and envious. And the second one is, don't deny that you are selfish and envious. Which I agree is odd advice. Why doesn't he just say, if you are envious and selfish, don't be envious and selfish. Why does it matter how you talk about it? But I don't know.
I think people might concede that being envious was wrong faster than they would concede that being ambitious is wrong.
Sure.
So because some people kind of brag about their ambition.
Although I can see it the other way too, because sometimes envy is so easy because you're just like, oh, poor me, I don't have the thing that I want. It's that feels more holy maybe than bragging about something you already have.
I have a footnote here that makes it clarify things a little bit for me. So it says, envy and covetousness poison spirit that are linked to self-centered and self-serving ambition. These vices blind one to true understanding and wisdom and are contrary to the love of a neighbor. So what if the false to the truth being God's wisdom, or denying the truth? So it's saying, do not boast about your jealousy and selfish ambition. So do not boast about this, and do not deny God's wisdom. So what if the truth in that case is
feel
that
like
God's
I would
wisdom?
Need a comma in there. That's
Mine
not
does
there.
Have a comma.
Yeah, I'm looking at the original Greek, trying to understand it, and it does seem to, there's a Greek word kata in there, which means facing toward or opposed to.
Ah, katri.
Yeah. It's along, facing toward, opposite. And so it could be, maybe it would be thought of to say, here it is, do not boast about it as opposite to the truth. So don't elevate your point of view as being better than the truth. Don't boast about it. Because the English puts a lot of other words in that the Greek doesn't actually put in. And it just reads, if I were to try to translate it, I'm rough on this, but to read it woodenly is, boast not opposite the truth.
So it could be saying,
or in the face of the truth, don't think you're smarter than God's way.
Mm-hmm.
Might be the way. Don't
could
boast.
It be in essence, if you're selfish and envious, don't deny it.
Yes, it could be that, but also don't be so arrogant that you think your truth. This kata could mean facing toward, among, opposite, against. So don't, the word is to, it's a present imperative second person. Don't tell lies.
The word truth, the truth in the verses that we were looking at, there was a little footnote, and it referenced James 5:19, where he says, my brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth, I'm thinking they mean the truth of God's word as a whole.
Mm-hmm. So I think the meaning could be as any of the things we said, but would also be legitimate to say, if in your heart you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition, don't brag about it, even to the extent that you would oppose the truth. That you would find yourself lying about the truth, that you would say things against the truth.
It just seems like an odd instruction.
Yeah. So maybe it's what call to true repentance. Don't just keep lying to yourself. Hmm. And maybe it follows then on the heels of the tongue deceives yourself, right? You set on course the whole thing. And
I guess when you add the second sentence in there, don't just say, well, this is the way the world works.
Yeah.
And no, that's not real
exactly.
Wisdom.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because if you think of cases in which our people are bragging about why they do the things they do, or trying to show about how great they are for doing wrong things.
Yeah.
It's because
or justifying the wrong things.
It's because what they're doing is they're boasting in their selfish ambition. In denying the real truth of the matter, which is not necessarily that they have selfish ambition, because they're boasting about it.
Right.
They're denying God's wisdom, the wisdom from above.
They're saying things like, it works. Well, you can't.
Everybody else is doing it,
or I'm not going to get caught anyway.
It's what the other side is doing.
Right. That's exactly where my mind went, too. Why do they only get to do this, and why can't we do it?
But then, you know, James continues on, and he describes that wisdom does not come from heaven. It's earthly, it's unspiritual, and he even goes so far as to say it's demonic, right? So it's from the evil side. And then he explains further, where you have envy and selfish ambition, when those things are present, if that's what you're really basing it on, you're going to find disorder and every evil practice. Mm-hmm. And so I think he is just trying to refute the idea, if you think this is the way to go, it just isn't.
It's not, it is not shrewdness to use the weapons of this world.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then the last paragraph, the 17:18, the description of heaven that comes from, or the wisdom that comes from heaven, has this list, like you said, Don, almost like the fruits of the Spirit, but it's pure and it's peace-loving, so it doesn't enjoy the fight, right? It tries to make peace. It's considerate. And look, it's even submissive. I mean, if you lay those terms down in front of the modern strong person's view of how to live, they would say, that's exactly why you're failing at your goal. It's because you're submissive. You're full of mercy. I mean, I think if I understand correctly, that's what irritated Nietzsche so much, is that Christians were kind to other people. He just couldn't stand it. And so true wisdom really is what the world perceives as weakness and failure. And it takes a lot of courage to believe this, because our world is pretty, I think it's always been, pretty screwed up in its values system.
Yeah, I was thinking about that recently, about how it's actually an apologetic for Jesus, because he is so countercultural in every culture. Mm. You know, I was thinking specifically with Palm Sunday coming up, the idea of God sending his son to be such a humble figure all the way through, and to ride on a baby donkey, to be born and be laid in a manger, to love children and women and the outsider. Like, these are all like timelessly offensive, which there's not that many things that all cultures have in common, but to put the weak above the strong is. And so that inclination within us to value the strong over the weak, going back even a couple weeks, that must be the world's wisdom. That must be our sin, because Jesus always did the opposite of that.
Which makes my mind go back to what you read from that Facebook post, Donna, is that what the world perceives as like being true to yourself and finding, you know, my truth and finding my identity is really a lie. The human being was not created in order to be independent and self-assertive, but rather to lose ourselves in a person that is greater than ourselves, to lose ourselves in a cause that's greater than ourselves. And so that's why Jesus would say, if you want to find your life, you need to lose it first. If you want to find what true life really is, you need to die to yourself and find your meaning in me. And it does go against our natural inclination, right? We want to be our own king, but it really is the greatest of all joys to find our self, our identity in the relationship with our maker and in a submissive role. And then to find true meaning and true purpose. I cannot produce a reality that is fulfilling to me. I can only find the one that God intended. And I find it by his grace. I'm given it as a gift, right? So I think there's a lot of relevance here to the power structures of the world. And I'm reminded of a message that Tim Keller's son gave, I heard a little while ago, but he talked about the four myths of our modern society: identity, freedom, pleasure, and power. That one of those four things or all of those will make you a person. And that's why our world is so preoccupied with identities and pronouns and trying to find who am I, who am I really, who am I? And the one who can say, I've really found myself, everybody else envies that, and yet they're lying, because we only find ourselves when we lose ourselves in the Lord Jesus entirely. So some of these things are pretty relevant.
I also thought, as I was saying, that no culture seeks to put the weak above the strong. You might have someone from our contemporary culture say, no, that's exactly what we are doing. We seek out the story of the oppressed and try to make them overthrow the oppressor. Like, that's a very popular critical race theory or
defines everything in terms of the oppressor.
I would push back and say that that is not what Jesus did either. They are seeking power.
They are.
And using different, we're using different metrics or different characteristics to gain that power.
Marxism kind of has the same thing.
You do not go to Jesus to get power.
Right.
You don't. Like, when Jesus welcomed the little children, he valued the weak and the humble, but he didn't say, and he said everyone had to become like them. But he didn't give them power
to take over
everything. Everybody else. It's like universally offensive. You all have to be weak and humble and submit.
Takes a lot of faith. So I guess this would be a good time to ask: How do we find and reveal the gospel in all of this? Is it exactly that, the high contrast in the value systems? How else might we explain the gospel from this passage?
If you're looking at it, talking about identity, I remember when I was in high school, there was this push, you know, to find yourself. Well, now some people have found themselves and not been happy with who their self is, so they gotta be a different self, because they're just not happy with what God made them. And it's interesting, what we should not be happy with is the sin in our lives. But the only way to fix that is not to become a different person. It's just to become a child of God, a person in Christ, and Christ gives us this new identity. But people are so busy trying to find their identity some other place, they don't even see that their true identity right now is lost. And that deserves punishment, and they will be punished if they don't accept Christ's payment for them. And all the rest of the stuff that people want to do to find themselves or change themselves kind of falls by the wayside once you see who you really are in God's eyes and who you could be.
In the wisdom of this world that seems to provide this identity proves to be so inadequate as you pursue it. I mean, no amount of jealousy or ambition or boasting is ever going to satisfy you, right? It's ultimately the wisdom of this world is as descriptive as earthly, unspiritual, demonic. It doesn't necessarily say it also won't work either, but that's ultimately what it is, right? I mean, this won't work in the long run. You may seem successful for a moment, but ultimately it's going to be fruitless efforts. It's going to be labor that's meaningless.
If you're envious of someone else's achievements and you work harder and harder and have all this ambition, there's still always going to be somebody that's better. Mm-hmm. Somebody that's got more of whatever it is you're trying to get. You'll never get to be the top because
If you are the kind of person who boasts that they are on the top, every single moment there's the constant worry and fear. Am I going to lose this?
There's
am I going to lose this?
Am that somebody will this? Surpass you.
And they will eventually, right?
Eventually you die.
They'll ride on the wheelchair into the operating room and not come out or something. You know, that you eventually lose this. It is sad that your life can be driven by bitter envy, right? That you would harbor this. You've been hurt, and you're going to get the world back. I've heard it before that some athletes have gotten to their level of accomplishment because they're ticked that their junior high coach didn't, right? You know what I'm saying? They motivate.
Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm.
Is that who? They motivate
themselves.
Well,
that Michael Jordan documentary, that was kind of the theme of it, is he was so good, he was already the top And he couldn't get motivated unless he had a personal vendetta against the person he was good. You know, I took that personally. I was offended by that. So that
would motivate him to play harder or to... And so he's driven by a bitterness, which is a sad way to live.
It's just certainly super sad.
Super petty.
Yeah.
And if you achieved it early, you worked and worked and worked and finally got whatever your goal was.
Kind of hollow.
Then what would you do? Yeah. What would you have else to work
I love
for?
Those stories. There's more than one, I think. But someone, athlete who reaches the pinnacle, wins the World Series, and immediately says, oh, I've got to pursue God. Like, they thought this was going to make them feel complete. And God gives them the grace to in that moment even, to say, oh, this is not enough. Mm. And, you know, some of us can't. That's what trusting Jesus is trusting that it is enough. To bet your whole life on it.
And it's true that a lot of people aren't there yet, because a lot of people would listen to that and say, well, that's ridiculous. You're saying this God thing's going to provide anything more than that. And ultimately, that's what the gospel is, that yes, he really does provide all of that. Everything he really is fulfilling in a way that those things aren't. And it seems so, because just as it has in all of history, because the wisdom of this world is so prevalent and people want it to be true so much, it's so hard for people to recognize that that is indeed the truth. It sounds ridiculous under the wisdom of
this
world.
But what a burdensome slavery if you think the only way you're going to be fulfilled is to reach the pinnacle of something that you may never reach and even know to experience to know it isn't. That, you know, if it really did depend upon you to make your life worth it, I mean, that's where depression comes from, because you're like, this isn't enough. I can't do this.
Even
I can't work every day. I can't.
Even if it did work for the 0.1% that make it, the other 99.9% is all suffering, but it also doesn't work for them either. So I think maybe the way the gospel most comes out of this is that this is in a lot of ways, a gospel presentation. This is the way you can live. You either live against this hollow set of idols that won't produce what you think they will, and that's what our world is full of, or you can embrace the weakness of the cross. And I think it goes well with Palm Sunday, too, because of the illustration of Jesus coming in on a donkey instead of a war horse. You know, that was a real surprise to the disciples. This is not working. So
I also think, Pastor, that like the whole gospel is an illustration of that contrast between earthly wisdom and heavenly wisdom, because I mean the world defines victorious. The disciples think that being victorious is for Jesus to overthrow the king and build his own kingdom, but the victory that God designed for him was for him to die. And
to overthrow hell. So I think that'll be good. In any final any aspects that you think our church in particular needs to hear or seems to be especially relevant? It seems like a good passage for election year, sort of. But any other contemporary reasons why it would be particularly meaningful?
If you look at verse 13 and you recall what the past several couple sermons have been about, going from James and the faith and works and the words and the tongue and taming the tongue, this 13 does connect it to those previous two sections that we read. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. So there is a component here that directly connects to, if you are a Christian, or if you claim to be, this is one of the ways in which your works will show your faith. If you have gained, or if you hold to the heavenly wisdom, the wisdom from above, by your good conduct will you show such things. In the meekness of wisdom, it's not a look how dumb that person was. That's the meekness of wisdom. It's a humility in still being right or still knowing what the truth is. We react with meekness with under controlness in the heavenly wisdom. It's not a let me prove you wrong and this is all the reasons why, right? It's
people think their wisdom comes from their education, their experience, their background, and like to share their wisdom. But it's almost ironic that the wisdom here, it comes from humility.
Mm-hmm.
And by having doing good deeds and showing with your life your wisdom, not just your mouth. It's so easy to start handing out wisdom.
And this is a good component to those who think too little of themselves, too. The wisdom that matters is not what is taught in a college education. The wisdom that matters is not come from a high socioeconomic status or a lot of financial success or business success in your life. You can have a life that doesn't meet any of the world's metrics for success and still understand the wisdom from heaven, right? That wisdom from heaven comes in spite of all those things, not because of all of worldly success.
It takes courage to believe that that's true in our world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pressures on us. You know, write your resume, compliment yourself, put your best foot forward, you know, all those things, and dress for success, name it, claim it, fake it till you make it. I mean, there's all kinds of things that happen in our lives that we're told to do that are not truly, essentially humble. Well, that's pretty good text, isn't it, Salat? And I do think you write it, and it makes sense that James would flow this out of controlling your tongue and having faith with deeds.
It's sort of like it's like if controlling your tongue is an example of how to have deeds that align with your faith, it's another example of how the deeds come out of your faith.
Yeah.
And come out of your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. I have another question or topic shift here. Easter is the week after this Sunday, and I had mentioned to you or to some of you before that I hadn't decided for sure what part of the text to use for Easter, and I've been landing on basically on your suggestion, Becky, from Revelation chapter 1 when Jesus reveals himself to John the first time. And then verse 17 of chapter 1, John says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. And then he placed his right hand on me and said, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I'm alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades.'" And so I thought I would take that phrase, "Don't be afraid. I'm the living one. I was dead, but I'm alive now, and I hold the keys of death and Hades," and say and go down three basic paths. Is we don't need to be afraid of seeing Jesus. I think sometimes people are afraid of the future. It's just so outstanding. And so when John saw him, he fell at his feet as though dead. And we don't need to be afraid because of who he is. And then secondly, we don't need to be afraid of dying, because he holds the keys of death and Hades. And then thirdly, we don't need to be afraid of living, because he is the one who's alive forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that would be a simple and yet profound way to benefit from the gospel and from the resurrection in a way that was practical. Don't be afraid to see God. Don't be afraid to die. Don't be afraid to live.
Can we include in that, don't be afraid to see God, that there's also a more immediate fear of we are reluctant to go to God in prayer because we view ourselves as guilty, but we are loved and justified. And
so not being afraid to see God, not only when and after we die, but even right now, while we're still here, don't be afraid of God in your life.
I think even people avoid coming to church when they feel guilty or they punish themselves. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities to bring the gospel in on that one.
So that's sort of a heads up as a preparation for next week. And so if you could think of ways to expand on those. Or if there's a fourth one, you know, don't be afraid to whatever the other, you know, if life is pretty
broad. I try to think about if someone doesn't believe in God to begin with, I just wonder what component would be resonate with them the most.
Yeah.
I think that the gospel, when is touches a heart, I think that it can be tempting when you were raised as a Christian. When you're raised as a Christian, it's important to learn apologetics and things that the proofs for God, you know, to like figure things out for yourself. But I do think that when you've been raised a Christian, you underestimate the power of the gospel message, in that it changes the heart as it is. It doesn't need to be, you don't need to build and scaffold existence of God. Yeah. It changes the heart and say, I don't believe in God. And then you hear the gospel and you're like, I give my life to Jesus. And then you kind of back out until, you know.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that all the apologetics need to go in there, but in a sense, if you're going to look at the, you don't need to fear to go in front of God. I suppose there are people who
ought to be afraid.
Well, not necessarily that. It's just like, well, why would I ever be afraid of that to begin with, kind of thing.
So or, that's a good question.
I don't know. It's just something that I was thinking about in that passage is how.
But they probably are afraid to die.
In their heart of hearts, I think that is true. Yeah, that fear of death.
And there,
some people,
and there's like the inner nameless angst that comes.
And some people boast and say that, oh, who cares what happens? I mean, this life is this life. If I go into oblivion afterwards, some people try to say they don't care about that when they probably do. When it really comes down to it.
So think of those things over this week as we prepare for next Wednesday night's sermon talk to see. Because I do wonder, you have a good question, Joe. How does an unbeliever get persuaded to not be afraid and to see their need in this case?
Or do they need to be recognize their fear in the first place?
Right. They need to be afraid.
How do you deal with
what they're facing as you stand right now.
Or maybe
giving
name to the fear in the first place.
You are facing something fearful, but there's a way out of that.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I said, I started with don't be afraid of seeing God was because that is the immediate case for John's experience, right? He saw something so overwhelming it freaked him out, right? Or he fell at his feet as though dead. So I feel like that should be addressed. And my first inclination was for believers who are afraid of the rapture because it sounds so scary that all of a sudden I'm going to lose my body and be floating up into the sky. I mean, you know, it's and so there's sort of this natural dread of the unknown that kind of comes into play. And I guess I want to build the case that when we understand who Jesus is and that he holds the keys to death in Hades, and he says, look at me, I used to be dead, I was dead, but now I'm alive.
Yeah.
So there's such good news. I've dealt with the real problem. You don't need to be afraid. So it's to teach us to not be afraid of the supernatural, to not be afraid of dying. You see what I'm saying?
I do, and I resonate with that even. But I still don't want to spend Easter thinking doing that.
Which way?
I don't want to dedicate the Easter message to that weird fear that...
No, it would just be the first part of the point that because Jesus is the living one who's left forever and ever, he gets rid of all of the possible fears I could have.
Yeah.
The fear of seeing God, the fear of dying at all, and the fear of living. What if I live the wrong way? What if I make a mistake? And he says, no, I got the keys.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder if people have that fear of God, that's the fear of, oh, everything about me is going to change in a way that I'm really going to hate. Or I mean, that can be kind of fear of God, too.
Yes,
it doesn't necessarily have to be that. Fear of the awe of the rapture. It can be like...
It's the unknown.
There's a component there. Yeah.
If I become a believer, am I going to have to switch which political party?
Am I going to have to... Yeah, exactly. Like there's a lot of practical things that feel scary, potentially.
So anyway, that's my rough start. So be thinking about it this week if you can appreciate what we come up with next Wednesday. Let me close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for our time tonight. And pray that we will be faithful in explaining how great the Lord Jesus is. Forgive us. Even in the church, we so often build our our systems and our programs around the idea of self-assertion and selfish ambition. Forgive us for the times we do that. Help us to lean on you and to embrace the weakness of the cross and the humility, the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men. And so we thank you for showing us the truth. In Jesus' name, amen.